Pentagon was totally off on these before. They overestimated the savings and they underestimated the cost.
Senator Begich fights the Eielson F-16's move. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a shorter route this summer to the Russian Far East.
Kamchatka's probably a lot like Alaska was maybe 50 or 75 years ago.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
The Air Force is set to release a report by May 31st on relocating the F-16 squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the state's congressional delegation is working hard to block the move.
Both Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich have met with Air Force Chief of Staff General Norton Schwartz this week, and neither seems to think the meetings were particularly encouraging. Murkowski says Schwartz recognizes Eielson's continued role in defending the West and North, but the report will likely advocate the move anyway. Begich's meeting with Schwartz left the senator questioning the Air Force's math and logic. He says Schwartz insists Anchorage can absorb the swell in population, even though, Begich contends, there's only a 2% vacancy rate. And that, to Begich, shows a pattern of the Pentagon's miscalculations.
If you look at the last BRAC they did, the savings and costs, the Pentagon was totally off on these before. They overestimated the savings and they underestimated the cost.
Eielson Air Force Base survived the Base Realignment and Closure Commission, or BRAC, in 2005. It's slated for a downsizing now, and the two senators have promoted legislation to block any move. Begich has also placed a hold on a key Air Force appointee until the report comes out. The Air Force aims to move the Aggressor Squadron and about half of Eielson's employees to J-Bear, and when it does, the Air Force expects to save more than $30 million over 5 years. Even if the Air Force moves forward with the plan, Begich says there's no way a BRAC could happen. That would have to pass Congress, and even most budget hawks won't vote to close a base in their home district. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Alaska Supreme Court today approved a redistricting plan for the 2012 elections. Alaska Redistricting Board Executive Director Taylor Bickford says the High Court has accepted the amended proclamation plan of April 5th, including voting maps for Southeast Alaska districts that the High Court had previously rejected. The state Supreme Court had asked the board to redraw the two Southeast districts as recently as May 10th, and the board submitted the changes, but the justices decided to reject those changes. Bickford says the justices were listening to Alaska Native objections to the recent changes to Southeast.
A number of Native organizations in Southeast submitted objections and argued to the court that they had really kind of missed the ball by determining that the Voting Rights Act didn't apply to Southeast Alaska. So we had argued all along that it was important to protect Alaska Native voting rights in Southeast. So what the court did today was essentially reverse their decision from May 10th and said, well, we now believe that we should go back to the board's first drawing of Southeast because that plan was already pre-cleared by the Justice Department.
Bickford says all aspects of the accepted plan have passed mandatory federal Department of Justice approval. He says the board is pleased with today's decision. The Supreme Court has asked the Division of Elections and other interested parties whether the candidate filing deadline should be moved. That matter is still unresolved. The Supreme Court's latest redistricting ruling resurrects a contest between two incumbent Southeast lawmakers. Today's decision puts Wrangell Representative Peggy Wilson in the same election district as Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson. They'll face off against each other as well as other candidates in the August 28th Republican primary. The new district matchup is only in place for this year's elections. Wilson now represents her hometown, Petersburg and Sitka, that would have stayed about the same under the Alaska Redistricting Board's most recent plan. But the earlier plan, chosen by the state Supreme Court today, puts her in a district with Ketchikan, Saxman, and parts of Prince of Wales Island. Wilson, reached on her cell phone on a trip to the Midwest, says the decision surprised her.
Well, of course, I'm disappointed because it's going to be a lot more work for me because of the fact that I just don't know a lot of the people in Ketchikan. So that means when I get back home, I'm going to have to get busy, start campaigning.
Ketchikan has far more people than any other community in the new district. Johansson could not be reached for immediate comment, but in past interviews, he said he preferred not to run against Wilson. Wilson feels the same way.
I just hate it, you know, because Kyle and I have been good friends up until now. And since the redistricting, you know, we've both felt uncomfortable about it. So it'll be a little strained.
Wilson and Johansson face at least two other Republicans in the August primary. Ketchikan City Council member Matt Olson is the only Democrat running for what will be called House District 33. Soon, Alaskan travelers won't have to fly nearly around the world to get to the other side of the Bering Strait. A Russian airline company is planning to launch direct flights between Anchorage and the Russian Far East for the summer season. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Mark Dudley is North America Regional Director for Interpacific Aviation and Marketing. He says Yakutia Air has scheduled flights from Anchorage to Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky beginning in July. Dudley says Kamchatka gets an estimated 50 to 100,000 visitors per year, far fewer than the 1.5 million who visit Alaska annually. So he says the area doesn't have the range of hotels, tourist attractions, and visitor services Alaska offers.
Kamchatka is probably a lot like Alaska was maybe 50 or 75 years ago.
But he says the vendors who are there provide good service.
They're very enthusiastic. There's a lot of operators there. Their hotels, the regional administration in Kamchatka has an entire office dedicated to encouraging tourism and sports exchanges. They have tourism year-round. They're well known for their winter sports.
The Kamchatka Peninsula has varied terrain with glaciers, volcanoes, hot springs, geysers, and wildlife and wilderness, Dudley says, are a huge draw.
Kamchatka is world-renowned for its fly fishing. Don't mean to cast aspersions on Alaska, where I know it's also amazing, but I hear wonderful tales coming out of Kamchatka about the great rainbow trout fishing, salmon fishing. There's just thousands of miles of rivers that are virtually untouched. So it's an area that holds kind of a mystique within the fly fishing public.
Dudley says his understanding is that airlines traveling between the Russian Far East and Alaska years ago dropped those routes for internal reasons, not because of a lack of business.
I see so much interest in the region from a variety of areas. I mean, not just fishermen, but geologists and other scientists, people in business, Alaskans who want to renew ties to the region that they started developing years ago, that I really think it's a very robust market, not one that's just going to be built on tourism.
According to internet search engines, one-way flights from Anchorage to Vladivostok, which is also located on the Kamchatka Peninsula, now take from 22 to 42 hours.
I just spoke to a gentleman from Alaska this morning, and he said he flies all the way around the world to get there. He's originally from the region, and it's not an easy place to get to, and I know of several people in that position. It's also possible to fly through Asia, through Japan, connect to Vladivostok and fly up. But until now, there has been no easy way to do it. It involves flying to Moscow, overnighting there, several very long flights.
So with these flights, it'll, of course, be just 4.5 hours away.
Dudley says tickets are available at the website airrussia.us for $2,600 round trip. The seasonal weekly Thursday flights start on July 12th and will end September 13th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, assessing the health of an important subsistence animal on St. Paul Island.
There has to be another herd or they're in real bad shape.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
Climate warming is causing the release of methane in the far north from a previously undocumented source. Past research has found methane created by biodegradation of thawing organic matter. But a University of Alaska Fairbanks-led study has confirmed a deeper, older source. UAF researcher Katie Walter Anthony describes the gas as geologic methane.
It's methane that was produced either by thermogenic processes or by microbes in the past. And that methane was stored in geologic reservoirs, in coal beds, or in natural gas deposits. And it migrated out of those reservoirs and hit a confining layer, either hit the bottom of permafrost or it hit the bottom of glaciers' ice sheet. It was trapped by that ice.
Melting of overlaying permafrost and glaciers are allowing the ancient methane to escape. Walter Anthony and fellow researchers surveyed Alaska and Greenland looking for unfrozen lakes in winter and then checked them for gas bubbling to the surface.
I realized right away that something was different when I saw how fast these seeps were bubbling, because I've sampled hundreds of seeps all around the Arctic and other places, and in all those places you can get nice little streams of bubbles, but nothing as violent as what we saw in these geologic sources. So it was obvious to me that a plug had been pulled and gas was leaking out of a bigger reservoir somewhere deep down.
Walter Anthony says lab analysis confirmed the methane was from geologic sources like coal and oil reservoirs, information which could lead to new resource exploration in some cases. She says the volume of geologic methane could rival ecological sources of the greenhouse gas. Methane is the third strongest greenhouse gas behind carbon dioxide and water vapor. As the Pribilof Island of St. Paul slowly emerges from a brutal winter, it's becoming clear the cold weather seriously damaged the island's reindeer herd. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports there might be some tough times ahead for locals who rely on the animals for meat.
It's a typically cold and windy day on St. Paul when I head out with amateur photographer Dave Childers to find the reindeer herd. People have told me they're not doing well, but I want to see for myself.
See them right there just to the right of the big cliff?
Yeah. We're near the Salt Lake, just north of town. It's one of the few spots on the island without heavy snow cover.
So which direction do we want to approach from?
I'm thinking if we go around this way, we'll come in downwind of them. There's less chance of them smelling us.
As we circle around to the right, I'm so focused on the herd that I almost miss the reindeer carcass.
That's one that was probably starved to death this winter.
What's left of the carcass is strewn across the tundra between patches of snow. The birds and foxes have clearly been here before us. Although we don't see any other dead reindeer, there are likely dozens, if not hundreds more, spread out over the island. At the beginning of the winter, there were more than 500 animals in the herd. A preliminary count this spring put the current number at less than a quarter of that. But Phil Zavadil, the tribal government's ecosystem conservation director, hopes to find more in parts of the island that are inaccessible because of snow.
The plan is to when the snow melts a little bit before the grass starts to grow up, is to go get out there and do a count of carcasses to figure out how many might have actually died.
In the meantime, Zavadil is contemplating what a large die-off might mean for management of the herd.
When we have a lot of them, we encourage people to go out and hunt, so we we keep that herd size down. But now we might be on the opposite end of having to limit how much hunting goes on.
The St. Paul tribal government has been managing the reindeer herd since the 80s, although the animals were first introduced much earlier, around the turn of the century. The original idea was that the reindeer would supplement more traditional foods like fur seal and seabirds. But over time, they've become as important for many residents. Richard Zaharoff runs a small reindeer meat business on the island. He hunts the deer, quarters them, and then ships them off to Anchorage for processing and distribution.
This year, I only dropped the eight animals due to the factors of weather, elements, snow.
Zaharoff wouldn't say how much money he made off of the harvest, but he did say it's a significant part of his annual income. All the same, he was mostly concerned about how a large die-off could affect local residents who rely on the reindeer for affordable meat in a place where ground beef costs $7 a pound.
Anything we could subsidize our community with, such as subsistence foods, is very important and critical to our community.
Back out on the tundra, Childers and I have managed to sneak our way, unseen, onto a cliff. About 40 reindeer are grazing beneath us.
That one seems to just be trailing behind all the time.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's sick or old or whether it just likes the view from the rear. But you're right, it does. Even yesterday when I was out here, that one seemed to be behind. And it's very noticeable because it's all white and no antlers at all. It might be an old cow, and just this may be her last year.
The rest of the reindeer don't look great either. They're skinny, and we don't spot the baby that was with the group the day before.
There has to be another herd, or they're in real bad shape.
If that's the case, the same holds true for the people who depend on the reindeer. The tribal government is planning another count next month. Reporting in St. Paul, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Investigators say this year's subsistence seal hunters are being very helpful in the ongoing effort to find the cause of a mysterious ailment that is bringing about hair loss and lesions. In the Nome area, about 20 animals with signs of the illness have been reported, but they don't appear to be new cases. APRN Steve Heimel reports.
Laboratory tests are ongoing, and the team working on the federally declared unusual mortality event say they continue to rule things out, such as radiation, fungus, and an increasing number of viruses. They keep investigating other potential causes, such as environmental contaminants, diet, and various environmental stressors. Gay Sheffield of the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program in Nome says the 20 or so seals they've been given so far this spring have been hairless and sometimes in bad shape. But hairlessness is happening anyway for seals at this time of year because they're losing their old coat of fur and growing a new one.
So this spring, now the seals have not had the opportunity to grow their hair back yet. So all winter they've been having the opportunity to wear off their hair, their old coat, and nothing came last summer. So they're seeing seals that look very I guess you'd call them very bald. Right now, we haven't seen or heard from the clinical side of things that we have any sort of new cases unfolding.
Back at the laboratory, Kathy Burek-Huntington of Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services says this is a great time to be getting new samples. Subsistence-taken seals offer the investigating team a chance to see the disease at a stage before it causes the animal's death.
Something that's helped us a lot with this is our hunter-killed animals that are submitted to us tend to be very early on in the process. And so they're actually quite key samples for us to look at because they're killed during the subsistence hunt early on in the process before they get to the point where all the secondary problems are developing and confusing the issue.
There are multiple laboratories working with the samples. One that recently started is Columbia University's Emerging Pathogens Lab. And Huntington says that lab has had several positive results from its high-volume screening process.
These are people that are going around the world looking for emerging pathogens, and they're very interested in helping us out with this problem. And so we have gotten a few possibilities as viral causes for the initial lesions, but we haven't so far confirmed.
It's too early to say if these results will lead anywhere. Often they don't, she says, because false positives are not uncommon due to the fact that all sorts of virus fragments are found all over the environment. Along with the potential clues and no new cases emerging, Gay Sheffield says the fact that both bearded and ring seals are being found that have survived the disease through the winter is also encouraging.
To me, that's somewhat of good news in that those seals are likely to have been survivors from through our very hard winter this year, and they've made it.
The working group is now sending out regular updates on a website hosted by the National Marine Fisheries Service. They're still advising hunters to avoid eating animals that appear sick or diseased. And for the most part, the seals are fine. Sheffield says the last thing they want to do is scare people away from their own food security.
While we've been talking recently about all the different testings and scary things that are are unknown in the future, I just would like to point out that we have no evidence that this issue that's happening with the seals is transferable to people or to animals, and that there are lots of healthy seals out there.
The population estimate for the bearded seal is in the hundreds of thousands, for the ringed seal in the millions. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Offshore gold miners near Nome will have to stay a half mile from river mouths and keep a 300-foot distance from fishing nets this summer. DNR and Fish and Game have drafted new stipulations for the 130 mining permits in the works. Fish and Game area manager Jim Menard.
We wanted at least a half a mile from the river, you know, to protect the out-migrating salmon smolt and protect the returning adult salmons for any disturbance from mining.
The new 300-foot buffer will apply to all set nets. The stipulations add that if a mining operation creates any turbidity, they must stay 500 feet from nets. Menard says even years have seen the biggest returns on subsistence fish over the past 8 years. He says odd years typically bring in about 30 ocean permits.
And then in an even-numbered year, there's going to be 50 to 60. So we're going to get a jump up in the fishing effort, and that's our concern, is now it's an even year. There's going to be increased number of nets out in the ocean here in the Nome sub-district, and judging what we're seeing from the permits coming in from DNR's reporting to us, there's going to be an increase of miners. So we just hope, there's cooperation on all sides.
DNR's Kerwin Kraus says no final decision has been made on what recourse lessees might have. He says he has not yet spoken with the impacted miners. Kraus says the half-mile rule will not affect recreational miners. Beyond the leases, several registered claims are within the half-mile range of rivers stretching west to the Sinuk and east to the Solomon River. Kraus says they will be impacted.
So you've acquired the right to extract it, and you have the exclusive right to it. That doesn't mean that you're going to be able to extract it with machinery if you can't get permits to actually conduct the work. And obviously somebody's not going to be out there with a gold pan and shovel, which is a generally allowed practice. You know, this is a typical situation where, you know, permitting and the mining law basically, which is very old, that grants the exclusive right to the locatable mineral estate, they clash.
And the DNR has hired a seasonal employee to help manage the increased mining activity. Former police sergeant Byron Redburn will serve in the role this summer. The DNR is still working to find a boat for Redburn to use. After 3 decades, the Sitka Fine Arts Camp is striking out in a new direction. Since 1973, the camp has taught thousands of kids music, dance, theater, and art. This summer, for the first time, they'll offer a camp for adults. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Roger Schmidt is the director of Alaska Arts Southeast, which runs the Fine Arts Camp. He says the camp has been considering an adult program for a while, but has never had the space. now there's no excuse.
I've heard from lots of people they want to do it, so we're throwing it out to see if people really want to do it, if people really sign up, fill up the classes, and then they have the opportunity. We'll get lots of feedback, presumably, from that, and we can evolve it however, you know, however it wants or needs to be evolved in the next years to come.
The opportunity to create the adult camp came when the trustees of Sheldon Jackson College gave the school's campus to the Sitka Fine Arts Camp in March of last year. Besides the adult camp, there will also be a new family camp for elementary age students, a circus camp, and a musical theater camp. But the adult camp is definitely a new market for Alaska Arts Southeast. Schmidt is fairly certain adults need what the camp offers.
When you're 14, it's important to stretch and do things that you've never done before because it opens up dimensions in you. It's even more important, I think. You know, we get as adults, we get so certain that this is what I do and this is what I don't do. And this idea that sort of, you know, we hatch and then we're done. And that's just such a sort of a tragic way to go about life.
Adult classes will be offered in two evening blocks from June 11th to June 15th, and campers can take one class in each block. Schmidt says the curriculum is less conservative than he first imagined. Campers can take, among other things, African drumming and dance, painting, understanding chamber music, and ceramics. And at an even slightly higher tempo, the camp will also offer adults Afro-Cuban dance, and for those interested in going airborne, trapeze and acrobatics.
I think the thing that, you know, that's so important for people is to play. And I just thought there's nothing more kind of playful and freeing than trying trapeze and acrobatics. Those are the acrobatics classes, really popular at the Fine Arts Camp for our students.
The adult camp represents some risk for Alaska Arts Southeast. The model is more or less untested. What Schmidt is certain of, though, is that whoever shows up will benefit, and he's got the adjectives to prove it.
Invigorating, lively, empowering, you name it. Same things that happens with the kids. Grown, increased self-esteem, increased social interaction, blah, blah, blah. We have grants that document this stuff.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Stephanie Joyce in St. Paul, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Nome, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.